giving an 18-minute snippet of our most fun or interesting lecture that we give. We're starting with Doug Abbey, who's going to talk about, teach at Stanford Business School, who's going to talk about the city. I'm going to talk about libel law and the leading case of Kynes v. Sullivan. And Mason's going to talk about how to do scores of music for movies. So we hope it'll entertain you. And we're sticking to an 18-minute deadline. After 18 minutes, boot us off, and the next guy will begin. So with that, Doug.
Okay, like in English 11, I'm going to start off with a question. The question is, if you were to walk in any city, it's up on the board there, in the world, what would be your favorite city to walk in and why? And I want you to turn to the person you're sitting next to and discuss this for 2 minutes, and then I'm going to go. Okay, we don't have a chance to hear from you all, but we're going to get started about what makes a city walkable. And I bet you on the streets that you walk, that you thought about, there was food and shops, important ingredient at the street. So we're, for me, it's walking down Hanover Street and having a cannoli at Modern Pastry. What makes a city great? When Justice Potter Stewart was asked, how do you define pornography? He says, I don't know, but I know it when I see it. And it's the same thing for a city. What makes it? Some cities are hot and fantastic places to live, and some are banal, and some streets are banal and scary. So what makes the difference? And if you're in the class of 1911, as my friends there are in the back of the row, including my daughter and her son-in-law, Derek and Catherine. Hey! So, if you lived in a city. If you're in the class of 2011, you want a city. Do you want to live in the city or in the suburbs? If you're in Cleveland, you probably want to live in Shaker Heights. You probably don't want to live in downtown Cleveland. If you're in Paris, you probably want to live in the central city. You probably don't want to live in the banlieue. And does anybody know where this city of the future is? It looks like the city of the future. It's got like green space and all that stuff. Where are we? We're in Detroit, okay? So this is Detroit up close. So what is the secret sauce? We're going to try to unpack that in 18 minutes. And we'll start with some quotes, if I can stand here, about the built environment. The built environment reflects society's values. And we start with Winston Churchill, who said, we make our cities and our cities make us. A Dutch investor friend of mine says, why do you throw away your cities in America and Las Vegas is replicating the failures of the future? And Enrico Peñalisa, the mayor of Bogota, wonderful quote says, the goal of a city is to create equality, safety, and happiness. If you do the right thing in a city building, you can make people happy for hundreds of years. So we're going to try to unpack what makes a city great, and we'll see a couple of photographs. And Jan Gehl, who designed the Broadway street closure, said, in great cities, people want to be in the public realm. So I've got a few shots of things that might contribute to great cities. And the first is walkability. Do you know where we are? This is Dublin, right? It's Joyce Day. Everybody's out for a Guinness. Where are we now?
Buenos Aires.
Buenos Aires. Where are we now?
New York. Chicago.
No, this is the Rose Kennedy Greenway in Boston, okay? All right. So, I'd like to tour a few continents. We'll only get to three today because this is an abbreviated lecture, and we're going to start with Europe. Have you been in a city in Europe and you're walking along, you're driving along, and there's a bunch of houses? And then it stops and the field begins abruptly. This is Dorset, this is Panbury, Prince Charles Town. And to me, why is it in Europe that the city and the boundary between the city and town and the countryside is so abrupt? It's in part because land use is a national decision made at the national level in Europe, and you can do that when a society is homogeneous. We're going to turn to the United States, which has a heterogeneous population, correct? And here's an example of heterogeneity in the United States. And here, this is LA in the 50s. Now, I decided one day I wanted to go out and see where the urban edge was. Now, if you want to find the urban edge in Los Angeles, you drive 2 hours and you get to Victorville. Who's been to Victorville? And Terry, and I believe that T.S. Eliot says this is the way the world ends, is with a whimper, not a bang. And Terry's been there. I mean, there is nothing going on in Victorville. It is the end of the world. So let's try to understand what is it in the United States that leads to a completely different pattern of land use than in Europe. And it starts with this wonderful building, catty corner from Italy, designed by Daniel Burnham, who said, make no little plans, they have no ability to stir men's blood. It's a gorgeous building. And 12 years later, some 120 Broadway was built. It's shaped like a refrigerator. And if you've been there, you'll see that it blocked access to light and air behind all of the buildings. And the conclusion was, we need to do something about this. We need to create zoning. So, zoning was challenged in the court system, and a lower court ruled with respect to whether zoning was legal. The purpose to be accomplished is to regulate the mode of living and segregate and classify the population according to their income and station of life. More on that in a moment. In 1926, it reached the Supreme Court, and Euclid Ambler ruled that it was a legitimate use of the police power for the government to exercise, to have zoning, to separate land uses into distinct districts, residential, office, industrial. In part, that was if you were next to a factory, you didn't want to have a house next to a factory because of all the smell coming, right? So we created what was called Euclidean single-purpose zoning. So what is the consequence of Euclidean zoning? We'll start with, let's see if we have a shot. So Euclidean zoning basically leads to land use patterns in the United States that I can summarize very briefly. If you live in the central city, you probably are near failed neighborhoods, traumatized neighborhoods, and if you go to the suburbs, you have sprawl. So there's something I call the sprawl coalition. Who is in the sprawl coalition? First of all, it starts with homeowners. If you live in Greenwich, Connecticut, as a few of our classmates do, and I want to go in and build 300 units of affordable housing, and you are an owner, the federal government basically went to the states and they created enabling legislation for the states to shift the power to regulate land use to localities through the general plan at the county level and at the city through specific zoning. So Greenwich has its own zoning, five acre lot zoning. So if I wanted to go and build 300 housing units in Greenwich, and if you are a homeowner in Greenwich and you're a rational person and you have the supply and more people want to live in Greenwich and you prevent anybody from building another house, what happens to the value of your own property? It goes up. So it's in everybody's interest to limit access to people that don't live there. If you are a renter, you're a policeman, you're a fireman, you're a low-income person, you want to live in Greenwich, you're a teacher there, you can't. So what happens is that we get what we call the sprawl coalition. And who's in favor of sprawl? The first one is the homeowners. The second member of the sprawl coalition is the federal government. Now, what did they do? They built the interstate highway system that emptied out the cities. We have a cheap energy policy in the United States. If we had $10 a gallon of gasoline, we would have different land use policies. And finally, we have the mortgage interest deduction, which causes people to consume more housing than they should. And this may surprise some of you, but I sound like Bernie here, which is that most of the benefits of the home of the mortgage interest deduction go to high-income people. So it's a wealth transfer from the average person to rich people, the mortgage interest deduction. So the third member of the Sprawl Coalition are environmentalists. Does that surprise you? In Marin County, near where we live, they raised $300,000 to stop somebody building 9 Habitat for Humanity's homes. So, environmentalists against anything, anywhere, and all that does is it leads to development being pushed to the periphery, which is not very efficient from a land use standpoint. So we all know how Athena was born, plucked from the brow of Zeus, fully born. Let's say you were an architect and you decided you wanted to build from scratch a city. I think that would turn on most people. So, does anybody know where we are? Oh, this is a gated community. And those of you who heard Tom Davis's talk talked about red and blue in neighborhoods segregated by income and even politics. You have red and blue suburbs. This is a gated community. You might think it's in Mexico City. No, it's in Orange County. Does anybody know where we are now?
Brazil.
So, Brazil was the first city designed with the airplane in mind. You got to it by an airplane. And it was designed by Lucia Costa, a land planner. He never went there because he didn't want to let the reality of the site impinge upon his view of the place. And it is a city that was built at one point in time. So let's take a look at it. These are beautiful buildings. Oscar Niemeyer designed them, and he won the Pritzker Prize. Beautiful buildings, bad planning. So here's what the city looks like. And Simone de Beauvoir said that the streets are wide enough to drive tanks through. And she also said there is no street. The incidental meeting of strangers and passerbys on the street. It never exists in Brasilia and never will. If you are on one side of the street and you're Johnny and you want to go play with Susie, you have to cross the freeway from one side of the city to another. So I don't think the planners can get it right. They say that great cities evolve and are not created from scratch. Let's go to A Tale of Two Cities. Which is the more interesting city, Beijing or Shanghai? How many people think Beijing? Raise your hand. How many think Shanghai? Raise your hand. Okay, I think Beijing is a horrible place. Beijing had 600-year-old, the Hutongs. How many have been to a Hutong? They're fantastic. 600-year-old ethnic communities with courtyards, intergenerational ethnic communities, and Mao wiped almost all of them out. But when you go to Beijing, about the only interesting thing to see in Beijing is the Hutongs and the Imperial Palace. Beijing has 7 ring roads, and the streets are wide. Remember those movies of people in China and everybody was on a bike? These streets are so wide, it's like Houston. Beijing looked like Houston, and they made owning a car cheap. When you go to Shanghai, I think Shanghai is fantastic and it's on fire. But we're going to use Shanghai as an example of what makes a city great. Jane Jacobs wrote a famous book, the most famous book in planning, called The Death and Life of American Cities in 1961. She was a little old lady in tennis shoes. Robert Moses wanted to wipe out Greenwich Village and build a freeway, and she said no. And she wasn't trained as an economist, and she wrote a book. And she has 4 attributes of what makes a city sustainable and vital. And I'm going to run through them quickly. The first is density. I bet you liked food and shops on your streets. You need density to support an adequate retail environment. That's the first ingredient. So there we are. And these are the Hutongs getting torn down. Here we are in Shanghai, and you can see the level of density. The next piece is, is mixed age buildings. In Philadelphia, she uses an example, Rittenhouse Square. It's not mixed age buildings and also design and height limits. And when they're different, it's like you could buy a Mercedes or you could buy a Chevrolet. And in the same neighborhood, if you have buildings of different ages, you get different price points and you get people with different incomes mixing each other, unlike the kinds of homogeneous suburbs that we talked about. So mixed age is the second ingredient. The third ingredient is mixed use, which flies against the face of what we call Euclidean zoning. And by mixing uses in the same spot, particularly residential is the key, because residential supports retail. And I see Richard Watkins here, who does a lot of mixed-use development. But when you combine different uses, you get activation of the street in 24/7. So mixed use is an important ingredient of successful urban environments. The last thing is what she calls pedestrians and neighborhood-oriented streets. And here's her block on Hudson Street. She talked about the sidewalk ballet, and she talked about safety. And how many of you walk down the street in the middle of the night and you're the only person, it's 12 o'clock, and you're the only person on the street? No matter where you are, you do this. You're not sure about your safety. You take that same street and you fill it up with people you're going to wander down. So eyes on the street were an important ingredient. And she talked about short blocks. Now, if you go to Los Angeles, or you go to, it takes 60 seconds to walk across the street, right, Terry? And if you go to Salt Lake City, the streets are so wide, it's the most horrible place, Salt Lake City is. And they had ox carts, and the ox carts were 8 wide. You had to be able to do a U-ey on the street, so that's why the streets are so wide in Salt Lake City. So active streets. When you go to Europe, and you're in one of those wonderful little towns, and you see the street curving, what does it make you want to do? It makes you want to follow and see what's around the corner. So the layout of a city is really critical to making cities great. So what happens when you combine them? It's magic. This is alchemy. When you combine them, you get some things. You get diversity. We talked about diversity of incomes, ages, population. You get safety, a sense of authenticity. Great cities evolve. You get serendipity, energy. I think we all know what. The streets that you talked about had some degree of these elements. And you could say that this is where young people want to live, the millennials want to live, where streets are active, and that it could be, that they could say, make an argument that these are fertile grounds for entrepreneurship and enterprise, innovation. So I'll close. I think I've managed to do this on time with just asking you all, when you go back to your cities and you're walking down to the streets that you live, are they walkable? And what are the ingredients, the four ingredients, and are any of them missing? And if they are missing, what kinds of things could you do as a city, as a citizen, and as a leadership to make the cities more interesting environments to walk in? And I will close with a credit to Professor Schmaltz. When I was a senior, I had no interest in art whatsoever. And as everyone said, you got to take history of art with Professor Schmaltz, introductory history of art. And we started the Caveman of Lascaux, and he ran out of gas right around 1700. But I'll never forget the lecture about the Corinthian columns and the Ionic and the Doric and the Romanesque and the Gothic cathedrals. It was a fantastic class. And my interest in architecture really grew out of Professor Schmaltz's class. Thank you very much.
Harry Belafonte, and a whole panoply of both blacks and whites,
put this advertising in the New York Times, essentially criticizing the Montgomery police for beating up on the civil rights workers. It was a full-page ad, and in the end, it did have some inaccuracies. And based on those inaccuracies about what the police did, the police commissioner of Montgomery, L.B. Sullivan, sued the Times. Now, the footnote and weird thing is that very few libel cases deal with ads, although this one, which turned out to be the most famous libel case in our history, did. And L.B. Sullivan was not mentioned by name in the ad, but since it was about him, it was about his police department, which he headed up, he was able to sue, and that was probably a correct decision. So he sued for libel, saying that this was inaccurate, it made the police department look worse than it really did, and he sued for libel against the Times. Now, the question I want you to think about, or try to answer, why did he sue the Times? Anyone have any idea why he sued the Times?
Readership, the biggest readership.
Well, no, they published the ad, so he had no choice, but why did he sue at all? Why, I mean, there were small mistakes, he was probably able to win. Stop the Times from writing bad ads again. Okay, any other thoughts?
Eastern establishment.
Eastern establishment. That's kind of getting close.
It was up for re-election.
No, nothing to do with that. I mean, basically the answer is, in a banana republic, if you're in a third world republic, and you basically, you know, have a coup d'etat and take over, what are the first two places that you want to control?
Press.
Radio.
The press and the radio is one. And the airport is the other. You control who comes in and out. You control what the people who are in here. You basically have them as your prisoners. So the point is that what the Southern establishment, of which L.B. Sullivan, the police commissioner, was one person, wanted to do, is they wanted to kick the Northern press out of the South. Because if they won verdicts, such as what L.B. Sullivan was about to win, the Northern press, which at that point was really only the New York Times, maybe the Washington Post. At that time, as you all know, in this room, there were only three networks. Maybe there was AP, maybe there was Time Magazine, but that was it. So if you got those guys to stay out of the South, you could beat up the blacks and the civil rights workers with impunity because no one was going to know about it. So the purpose was to get some damages against them, monetary damages in these libel cases, not to win money, but to deter them from reporting on the abuses that were going on, enabling the abuses to continue and segregation to continue. So that was the reason L.B. Sullivan sued. And sure enough, when he sued in Alabama, not surprisingly, he won $500,000 from a Southern jury as a verdict. That was affirmed on appeal and affirmed again on appeal to the Alabama Supreme Court. So the case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, appealed by the Times. But basically, the opinion, the verdict was right. I mean, there were falsities, there were some slight inaccuracies. That was enough to carry a libel case. So the Times lawyers had to come up with some new theory to somehow win the case. And for that new theory, they went back to the 1790s and 1800s and the adoption and then repeal of the Sedition Act. Does anyone know what the Sedition Act is all about?
Said something negative about the government, you were seditious.
Right, you could say something negative about the government. Now, why did we have a Sedition Act? Where did that come from?
John Adams.
It came from the English, right? The English had a Sedition Act. You couldn't say anything bad about the king or the queen. The weird thing is, why the hell did we adopt that ourselves when we basically had just revolted from the British? If we imitated the very laws we were fighting against. So 10 years after the Sedition Act was passed, it was repealed, saying in our country, we don't believe in that. We believe in free speech. We believe that you should be able to say negative things about the government, you know, by the people, of the people, for the people, and therefore they repealed the Sedition Act. And in that repeal, the Times lawyers, in this brief to the Supreme Court that actually, an original copy of which I have here, dated 1963, I guess, they argued that because of the repeal of the Sedition Act, that proved that in our country we were committed to saying negative things and are protected from saying negative things about the government. So therefore, some slight mistakes that appeared in these ads shouldn't be enough to allow the government to sue you to make you spend lawyers' money in defending yourself, and then indeed to lose and have to pay money to government for the right to say these things, even if they were slightly false. So that was the Times' argument, which really was quite revolutionary. I mean, nothing like that existed in libel law in our history. It exists nowhere in the world today, even 50 years later. Basically, where I'm going with this and what the Supreme Court decided has not been replicated by New Zealand, by Canada, by Australia. They've all said, no, this is too protective of the press. We're not going that far. But that was the Times' argument. That's all.
Who were the lawyers for the Times?
The lawyers for the Times were Herbert Brownell, who actually, it was actually the law firm of Lord Day and Lord. And Brownell is the first name here, who was really an establishment Republican under the Eisenhower administration. And Herbert Wexler, who was a famous constitutional law professor at Columbia.
I think Brownell was Attorney General of the United States.
Correct.
So they argue this to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court essentially decided in the Times' favor. This was the Warren Court, 1964, a liberal court, coming up with a rule of actual malice. So it used to be, as I said, that it had to be false and defamatory. You didn't have to prove anything else. Reputation was damaged enough. The same way if those light fixtures fell and hit Mark's head and Mark sued, you would win, right? Because light fixtures aren't supposed to fall on your head. You wouldn't have to go very deeply into the case. And it's the same with libel. If it's false, if it's damaging, you win. Now the Supreme Court said, no, that's not enough. Well, we're going to have to make the plaintiff prove that the publisher was at fault. Okay, bringing a new element of fault. You have to prove fault. And that fault in the case of a public figure or public official, such as the police commissioner of Montgomery, that fault really was something they called actual malice, which has nothing to do about malice, which they define as a reckless disregard for the truth, but it has nothing to do with recklessness either. So it's very confusing because lots of libel verdicts get reversed on appeal because neither the judge or the jury understands what actual malice is because it's a misnomer. What actual malice is, what the Supreme Court ultimately said the rule was, is that the publisher, the reporter, had to, in his mind, have serious doubts as to the truth when he published the material. He had to have a conscious awareness of probable falsity. Now, that is a huge, high burden to meet. How is an outsider who's been written about going to prove that the reporter has reckless disregard and serious doubts of the truth? Hawk, if you were the reporter and you were on deposition and I asked you, but Mr. Hawkins, did you really believe what you wrote about my client? What would you say?
Depends on the definition of is.
That's awful, really helpful. Hawk would say, yeah, I thought it was true. That's why I'm wondering. Maybe it ended up being mistaken, but I thought it was true. If he testifies to that, how are we going to prove, has a plaintiff going to prove serious doubts of the truth? And the answer is you can do it through emails and through drafts and try to get circumstantial evidence enough to prove that Hawk did have serious doubts, did have doubts about what he was printing, but it's very, very hard. Now, the criticism is that it's too hard, that public people won't go into the public life because they won't be able to sue, and Donald Trump says he wants to open up the libel laws, whatever that means. It's very ironic because Trump is actually much more likely to be a libel defendant than a plaintiff, even though the BS is used. But it's all opinion, so he won't really lose those cases. But what Justice Brennan, who wrote the opinion in Times v. Sullivan, said was, number one, that the whole principle is because we have a national commitment to wide open, uninhibited, and robust debate on public issues. And if you're going to have that sort of debate, there has to be some breathing space for mistakes to be made. So we have to anticipate mistakes and live with them if we're going to have real debate in this country, because we don't want newspapers deterred from getting into public issues for fear of making a slight mistake that might cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars and perhaps even the newspaper's livelihood and ability to continue. In fact, who here is from a kind of a small town? Does it have a small newspaper? Yes, okay. So, Jeff, let's say you were a publisher of a newspaper in 1963, before Times and Sullivan, and your editorial team came up with all this evidence that the town council was corrupt,
okay? But you didn't have kind of the final nail in the coffin, you know? You didn't have really the thing to really stick them, but you kind of knew that it was true, and you were ready to run the story. In 1963, if you were a wise publisher, when the law was, well, if you make a mistake, you're going to get sued and you're going to lose, would you run such a story? And the answer, as Jeff says, is no, because if you make a slight mistake, you're going to get sued, you're going to get screwed, you're going to be out of business. And what Justice Brennan said, that can't be the case in our country. We're committed to public debate. So therefore, we're going to put in this hard standard. And if you were the publisher in 1965, after the Sullivan decision said you can only lose if you have serious doubts of the truth, do you think anyone on your staff had serious doubts that there was corruption in the government? So you'd say, we can go ahead and run the story. We're going to win if they sue us. And in fact, they probably won't sue us because they know they're going to lose. So it's a vast difference in the way the media is going to behave and the level of public debate that will be out there. And sure, we're going to have some false facts occasionally, but better to have those than to snuff out debate and discussion about these things entirely. Still possible for a plaintiff to win, but it's very, very hard. But it should be hard. And that was really the point of the Sullivan case. And then that got kind of expanded from public officials to public figures as well. And then you do have a problem, and I have a problem, even as a First Amendment advocate, that, you know, should the same thing be true for celebrities? Is learning about Madonna's sex life, let's say, and having falsities about that. And Hulk Hogan came with privacy, so that's a little bit different. You know, is that something that deserves all that much protection, too? Do you think the forefathers, when they created the Constitution and the First Amendment, had in mind gossipy news about celebrities' sex lives or drinking lives or drug lives, as opposed to the real public issues? And the argument is, well, they're role models, they're important people, you know, they don't have the same protection. And I actually think that that's a little bit debatable. You know, when I teach this to my classes, I try to get them kind of riled up, because in the end, the point of what this does, right, is that the media, the reason you're in J school, I say, is because what you guys are going to write and what you're going to represent is really important. What was the key moment in the Chinese student revolution in 1989? Huh? The photograph that went around the world of the kid in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. If anyone remembers this movie, which I think went on far too long, Gandhi, climax of Gandhi came like an hour from the end of the movie, where he's on a salt march into the desert, and he goes into a payphone. Remember what those were, payphones? Why there's a payphone in the middle of the desert in India, I never figured out. But he goes into the payphone, and he comes out and said, we've won, the Times is writing about us. Because after all, he marches to the, you know, through the desert, and no one cares, no one knows in the rest of the world. What good is he going to do? But the point was the Times, and I assume it was the London Times, not the New York Times, but I don't really know. The Times was writing about it. That was going to bring pressure to bear from England and from the rest of the world on the guys that he was fighting with, and it should kind of ensure their victory. So this stuff really matters, I tell my students. I hope it does. And that's really, though, why the Sullivan case is so important. George, one more thing I got to say. Right, right. But the law is that if you're a vehicle of a letter to the editor or quoted by someone, you still can be sued. That's general libel law. That includes an advertising. It's rare. It's very rare. But that's what the technical law is. Thank you very much.
Hi, guys. This is called Two Phone Calls. It's about what happens to a composer between two phone calls. The first one's from my agent. The second one's from my mother, okay? And this is the way it works. Phone rings. The agent says, I want to talk to you about a movie. Explains what it is about, who shot it. He said, listen, they're at a point now where they're talking about a composer. pretty much finished with editing. They've got a mixed schedule for 5 or 6 weeks from now, and I thought maybe you'd be right for it, and he sends you the script. The whole object here is to take a meeting. You read the script, you put together on SoundCloud, which is a website, a number of cues. You upload them, it's like Dropbox, upload these cues and provide your agent with a link. He sends it to the producer of the film. They listen to these cues. The whole object here is to make what's called a short list. You hear a few days later that you made the short list and you have a meeting. So you're going to go into the edit room and you're going to meet with the director, the producer, and the editor. Frequently, you'll get in there and they'll actually show you the film as it sits now, or at least a scene or two. Then you sit down with them and you talk. And the fact of the matter is, at this point, it ain't about the music. At this point, it's about who you want to be in a room with. I once did a movie and everybody seemed to like the music. It was a very bad Western called Last Outlaw. But people liked the music, and I told my agent, he said, I hear things, pretty good things about the music. I said, yeah, I want to play you some. He said, I don't need to hear it. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's not about the music. He said, at this point, it's all about relationships. And that's what it's about, who you want to be in a room with. So assuming that meeting goes well, 2 days later, you hear from your agent, he said, you got it. He said, we're going to worry about the money later. Everybody's always worries about the money later. He said, you start now. They're going to send you, they're going to bounce on a satellite the film. You're going to watch it tonight the way it exists now. They're still cutting. More about that later. But they want a spot in 2 days. You get the film. You take copious notes, of course. You watch it. It's what's called a rough cut, although it's close to a fine cut, which is close to what's called a lock picture. A lock picture today is the biggest lie in the world, and I'll get to that in a second. But you take all your notes, and you go into what's called a spotting session. Now, a spotting session is really a wonderful thing in life. It's a very, very synergistic moment. Basically, you spend a day, and it usually doesn't go more than a day, seated in the editing room with the editor, the director, the music editor, who is your ally, friend, and dog's body, and yourself, the four of you. Usually the producers are barred from this meeting. Too many cooks. You go through the film. The film has time code on it. It has a running clock on the picture along the bottom that reads hours, minutes, seconds, and frames. There are 30 frames in a second. Okay? And you decide where and when each separate piece of music starts and stops, and what the nature of that music should be. Now, you usually have a thing called temp music. Temp music is temporary music taken from anywhere in the world that's been put into the film. Temp music, it can be your friend, but it's more often your foe, because the first you get into what's called demo love, which is the first thing that works is the last thing you want to hear. In other words, they fall in love with their temp music, and they want you to do the plagiarism waltz, where everybody recognizes the music you write except the lawyers or the guy that wrote it first, okay? And you have to fight that temp music love every step of the way. So you go back and you start to write. And you've got notes, copious, copious notes from your music editor that says things like, at such and such a moment, a person turns, a person blinks, cut to. And you have many moments that happen inside each cue. And these cues break down. Let's say on average there might be 50 or 60 cues in a movie. They average 1 minute, but some of them are 8 minutes long and some of them are 3 seconds long. Okay? But you have to think. You have to divide and conquer. You have to start writing the music for this film and decide what you're going to write first. You can back write. You don't write chronologically. There's no point to it. Believe me when I tell you the director wants you to have that entire movie ready in 24 hours because they've been working on the movie forever. You know, there's an old joke about Hollywood where a director sitting in a screening room watching a movie. It's 1 a.m. and a friend of his calls. He said, what is you doing? And the director says, well, I'm sitting here watching the movie. And the friend says, well, how is it? And the director says, I don't know. I'm here alone. Nobody knows anything. That's William Goldman's famous line. Nobody knows if it's any good. The director and the editor never get to see their movie for the first time. You do. So you have tremendous, you know, you have an opinion on how this movie works and what it's about. But believe me, they care more about this movie than you do because it's their baby. They've nurtured it. The director's nurtured it for a year or two. The editor for a few months. They come on after the shooting's done. And you need to make them happy. So you need to come in with cues. Now, in the age of sampling, and you know what sampling is, in the age of sampling, you can really write an orchestral score that sounds surprisingly convincing with synthesizers. Unfortunately, that tail will wag the dog too. I did a movie once called Key Exchange, and I did a cue set on a Long Island Expressway, a very steamy sex scene, thank you, Jesus. I did it on synths, cheeseball synthesizers. I played for the director. He said, that's good. I said, wait till you hear the real thing. I go and I do it with a full orchestra. I come back. He said, what the hell is that? I said, that's that cue you like so much. He said, no, no, no. I liked that cue. I said, that cue with this cheeseball whiny little synthesizer? He said, yeah, it's going in the movie. And it went in the movie. So you have to watch this when you demo. If you demo too well, they'll never give you the real orchestra so you can show everybody how good you are, you know. So you progress and you go, you're up against the clock. The problem you have here is that editing has become a digital game, okay? It's a video game. You used to shoot on film, and when you shot on film, it actually forced a discipline on the movie-making process where you did a thing called cutting negative. You literally cut negative. You cut film, and when you were finished cutting, you cut negative and put it together, and once you'd cut a negative, you could not restore it. Your editing was done. When you had to do a dissolve, you sent it out to a lab, came back 3 days later. Dissolve's where one picture merges into another slowly. You saw what it looked like and decided whether that worked or not. Now, if you want to try a dissolve, you do this. Done. The problem is, people can't stop editing. And they really can't stop editing. So you're chasing a moving target. You write music for what you think is a great scene. You go in the next day, and they say, oh, geez, we meant to tell you, we recut that last night. And they never stop cutting. And they never stop cutting for some very good reasons. They have marketing screenings. They have test screenings where they'll show the film to a movie full of people who will sell an evening of their life for $25 and fill out a questionnaire and tell you more than you want to hear about that movie. And the problem is they all have an opinion. And movies get changed at the last minute. I did a movie called Music of the Heart, which was a vehicle for Meryl Streep, a wonderful film. It came out great. We were all real happy with it. I went on and did another movie. 3 months after I did the second movie, the phone rang. And the director said, Wes Craven, great guy. Wes said, we've been having some test screenings, and Harvey says we're going to take 20 minutes out of the movie. I said, really? I thought everybody was real happy with it. He said, yeah, we are, but we're taking 20 minutes out. I said, well, which cues have to change? He said, all of them. We're taking 20 minutes out, a second here, 2 seconds there. I said, what? I had a year of my life on that movie. But they paid me again, and I did it again. And they took 20 minutes out of that movie. So these things all have a tremendous impact on the later production, on what's called the post-production schedule. So you're chasing this target where they're continually editing, you're continually rewriting. Meanwhile, you're trying to really get this score so it has some integrity and some thematic quality. And finally, you decide you're pretty much done because they're running out of time and money. That's what usually happens, you know. Then you go to score it because you don't score until the last minute. Here's why. You can do, by union regulations, you can't do more than 15 minutes of music in a 3-hour session. Well, you're lucky if you get that much done, frankly. If you've got an hour's worth of score, you're going to take 2 or 3 full days with a full orchestra. Let me run the numbers by you. It's a lot of money. Okay, it's tens and tens of thousands of dollars. So you don't do this halfway through the movie. You do this at the very end so you don't have to do it again. You've rewritten the music on synthesizer because it's a pretty good approximation. Gone are the days when Henry Mancini would sit down and say to Blake Edwards, he'd say, okay, this is the piano. I mean, this is the oboe when he'd play a melody, and this is what the French horn does when he'd play a melody, because nobody can tell. You know, it made for an awful lot of drama at the last minute when the directors finally heard what it actually sounded like in the orchestra. Nowadays, we don't have that problem. We model it on synthesizers, and believe me, they're real good. So we have a tendency to not have any issues at the actual sound recording. In fact, I went to a Zimmer session for the last Pirates of the Caribbean, and I was amazed that the director wasn't even there. He said, I know what it's going to sound like. He didn't even show for that, which is where we're at this point with synthesizer modeling. So you finish that, finally. Then you have the mix. Well, the mix is an interesting moment where you're going to be, some people call it a dub, where you're going to add sound effects, music, and dialogue. While you've been doing the music, the director tries to stay in touch with you, but the director's very busy. People don't realize that this part of post-production, the director's got a lot to do. What is he doing, or she? They're not only writing her to the music, they're doing credits. I don't know if you know this or not, but credits are not done by the people who make the movie. They're done by separate companies. You audition companies who come in and pitch you on the credits, and they go off and make the credits, and people have to decide on them and write her on the credits. Also, looping, ADR, automatic dialogue replacement. Looping is really where you change, where you replace dialogue. Frequently, you will also replace all the swear words so you can do a PG version for network TV. You know the F-bomb becomes freaking, and you do all of those very, very carefully. And you will also sometimes do strange accents that will do some semi-foreign versions. Looping is a very, very important process in filmmaking and very tedious, where you get all the principal actors. It's funny because you can shoot a movie anywhere, but they still tend to post in Los Angeles because of looping. We could write music anywhere. I've recorded a dozen Disney movies in Boston. That's not a problem. But looping, the actors live in L.A. So unless you get to bring all the actors to wherever you are, you bring Muhammad to the mountain, you go to L.A. and you have a looping studio there, and you loop all the principal actors, because frequently there's just invasive noises on the soundtrack. There are a million and one reasons to loop dialogue. You loop all that. When all that's done, when they've decided, at least for now, the cut is finished and the music is finished, you're going to go into the dub. The dub is about 3 days long. When the dub is done, you have an actual... By the way, when we dubbed originally in my first movie, Return of the Scott to Seven, we used to dub in a studio with film, and the film didn't have fast rewind. I mean, that's how much we've come. They would show the film, we would mix all the things against a reel. Things were done in 10-minute reels back then, roughly 10 minutes. And then we'd have to rewind to look at the reel again, and we'd go out for 10 minutes to stand in the hallway while they rewind. Then somebody invented fast rewind. We thought, wow, we died and gone to heaven, you know? Then somebody invented what's called four-track mag, which meant for four tracks of audio, you could have one for dialogue. This is how important we were back in the day. One for audio effects and two for music, so we had stereo. And that's when we were sure we died and gone to heaven, you know? After that, we went into many multiple tracks. In fact, movie mixing was responsible for multi-track recording. It first happened on movie sets, and from there it spread to the record industry with Les Paul and Mary Ford. So when we finally get the dub done, and we've got what's called an MP&E tracks, we've got music, effects, and dialogue, when they're all done, then and only then are we pretty much released from that job. The only thing left there is to do interviews and EPK, electronic press kit stuff, because when they release the DVD, they release that with interviews from all the people connected with the making of the movie. And then we sit around and wait on tenterhooks for the movie to come out and be reviewed, and pray if you're a composer you don't get mentioned, because they only mention us when they don't like the music. Henry Mancini's autobiography was called Did They Mention the Music, because he lived in terror that they would mention the music, as great as he was. And then eventually my mother calls, and that's the last phone call, and says she saw it, she thought there were too many naked women, and why wasn't the music louder, you know? And that's how it works for me, okay?
Started to do instead was to fly. some cases actually bankrupted the publications in question.
Yeah, that's true, but it's interesting that now that's happening less and less, because one of the reasons they did that was not only to try to bankrupt the publication with legal fees, but also show up at their country club or their church. You know, if someone said something bad about you in a small town, you really, in the old days, were kind of in trouble. And the only thing you could really do is sue, and say, well, I'm suing the bastards because everything they wrote was false. And everyone kind of then accepts you a little more. But now you don't need to do that, because now you go on the internet and you blog and you get people to blog for you. And so actually we felt that the internet was going to give rise to far more libel litigation. It would be good because we could make, lawyers could make more money. But in fact, the opposite took place. Rather than having more cases because everyone's sloppy and running 24/7 and not getting editorial filters, what happened really was that A, no one really cares what's on the internet because no one believes it anyhow. And B, you can correct it right away. You can correct it within minutes, whereas in the old days, you could correct once every 24 hours, maybe. And so the result of that is that there are really less suits now than there ever were. Any questions for anyone else? Yeah.
Question for Mr. Abbey over there. My question is this: how do you feel about mandatory inclusionary zoning to acquire affordable housing units in market rate buildings and kind of reserve 25-30% at below market so that the market rate units are subsidizing?
I'm going to answer it in two ways. First of all, Massachusetts has a great law. It's not quite what you're talking about, but it says that a jurisdiction has to have its fair share. And if you don't, you can force the developer to go in and develop in places where there's not been enough low-income housing. I think that's really good public policy. If you make the mandatory too high, it becomes confiscatory, because then people like Richard Kent, because he's still here, can't develop. If you make a 30%, you basically are taking away any economic. So the best way to do that is to give somebody a benefit by the density bonus. Give them something they wouldn't otherwise have, and then have them create more affordable housing. That's a good solution to it. But you don't have to be punitive, because then you stop development, and if you stop development, then the price goes up, and then more people are priced out of the market.
Yeah.
Well, this is for Mason. I'm just trying to get a sense at all of you're watching the film, and you're going to do soundtrack. What triggers what you end up doing? Is it like just, you know?
Well, you get better at it with time. I mean, I used to be getting a look at it and just be like, I don't know. I just do the play just once. I'll listen to the demo, something just like that. Now it becomes a little easier. But I will tell you, when I teach, I say, one of the things you must like is the physicality of it. Where I take scenes of mine from movies and then strip the music off and have people write, because I know what the director wanted them. And for example, the first one is the kiss. I say, you're going to score a kiss. Sooner or later, you guys are going to score a kiss. So, what how do you score a kiss? And of course, a lot of
no, how do you score, I think, is the question.
And so, a lot of it is, what happens around the physical touch of the lips? I score a gunfight. What happens around a gunfight? What happens around a physical another fist fight? I mean, a physical abduction with somebody's up. I said, you cannot underestimate the importance of the frame in which a man is shoved into a car. Alright? So he's walking down the streets of Tijuana, and out of nowhere somebody comes and shoves him into the car. How many frames between the man and the man first touches him, and then how many frames? What a lifetime is like 1.3 seconds between that and when the car door closes. You really need to be aware of those moments, by frame. In kissing, you need to be aware of usually people touch before they kiss. They embrace someone. Somehow, I go back to battery, I actually quote them a long battery. I say, look, you know, battery is considered, he's still there. Then you wouldn't let me do it anymore. Battery is the offensive intention, touching, and there's a little more than that, unforbidden and unprivileged, of one person by another. The law, Western culture, says when two people touch, if it's not affection, then it might be something else. You must be aware of that precise moment in time when two bodies touch and what leads up to it. And it only leads that I find what's actually free. And I usually write, I usually hate the first half of the movie because I'm just, you know, I'm wandering around the wilderness bumping into trees. And then all of a sudden I realize I actually know my lexicon. I know I'm going to never have any brass in this film. I'm just going to have woodwinds and strings and maybe a nylon string guitar. And then once every score has its own rules, once I know what those rules are in the second half, then I've got some melodies. I can apply them to the rest of the cues, and that's a lot of fun. First half's terrible.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you. Oh, that was great.